WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest, Francine Duplessis Gray, is a novelist and journalist. Or as she puts it, she's equally interested in the poetry of fact and the fact of fiction. Her new book is a collection of her magazine articles from the past 18 years on politics, religion, and women in the worlds of literature and fashion. There are also pieces about Gray's own development as a writer. The book is called Adam and Eve and the City, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Francine Duplessis Gray grew up in France, where her father died during World War II fighting in the resistance. During the German occupation, she and her mother fled to America. Her stepfather in America was editorial director for Condé Nast Publications. Early in her career, Francine Gray wrote for a French fashion magazine. Since then, her work has been published in The New Yorker, Vogue, Vanity Fair, and The New York Times. I spoke to her earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked if she thought there were themes that emerged in her new collection of essays that unite her work.
Yes, I think the dominant theme is memory, is a necessity of memory, both individual and historic, to enable the conscience, the individual conscience, to work at moments of critical historical moments. So that I think it is really a book about memory and how memory works and the interaction between individuals and the historical moment is how I look at the book in general.
You've alternated during your career between writing novels and reporting. And you credit poet Charles Olson, who you studied with at Black Mountain College, with teaching you that fiction isn't necessarily more creative than nonfiction is. Would that have been a hang-up for you if you hadn't come to that realization?
I think it would have been, because I think that since several decades, the literature has really been controlled by the consumer market. And the consumers like to label artists. I mean, you're either a fiction writer or a nonfiction writer. And I don't like to be labeled. I like to avoid any typification. And I think what Olson really did for me is to teach me a piece of history and to stress always that some of the greatest works of literary art throughout all times, be it Gibbon's History of Rome or James Agee's Let Us Not Breathe for Famous Men, were works of nonfiction, could be as great as fiction, and to destroy the distinction between the two and just look at all literature as text. And that's really what he did me and liberated me a great deal.
You studied at Black Mountain College, which was a radical utopian school that graduated a lot of the American avant-garde. But you also studied at Bryn Mawr College, which is one of the, most important women's academic colleges. How did you end up at Black Mountain, given the background that you had?
I think I went to Black Mountain like a cow goes to the Salt Lick, in the sense that you often go towards those opposite poles of experience, which you really badly need to balance out your personality. And I had a very straight-laced European education. Then I went for 7 years as a scholarship student to a very straight-laced girls' school in New York, Spence, and then I went to Bryn Mawr and Barnet. By the time I was 20, there was something in me which needed to just burst out of those constraints. And I saw an ad in the New York Times once saying that Bob Motherwell was teaching painting and Ben Shahn drawing and John Cage music and Merce Cunningham dance. And I thought, let's go. and ended up there, and I think it changed my life. It really geared me into being a rebel in terms of literary form as well as a political rebel.
Well, Charles Olson, who you studied with, convinced you that when you wrote, you should really write about what you knew,
yeah,
what you knew best. Mm-hmm. What had you been writing about that made him say that?
Well, I'd taken this lousy little fiction workshop at Barnet in my junior year, in which I was constantly writing because I was hung up on the idea that the only noble writing is fiction. I was writing these horrible short stories about themes or people I never knew, I didn't know anything about. I was constantly in one series of stories in my junior year. For instance, I was a middle-aged alcoholic actor seeking salvation in a church in the theater district of Manhattan, you know, on 10th Avenue and 46th Street. Now, that's obviously a situation that no 20-year-old woman of my education would know anything about, and they were lousy. And Charles Olson said, stop writing this fictional nonsense and do nothing but keep a journal for 10 years and don't even try to publish anything for 10 years. And I did that. And right at the end of that 10-year period, something happened.
What happened?
I rewrote an autobiographical essay about my childhood, which had gotten me actually the writing prize at Bonn in my graduating year in 52. I rewrote it in 62, 10 years to the date after Olson had told me to not publish, and I sent it to the New Yorker, and they bought it. And that was a piece called The Governess, which turned out still 12 years later to be the first chapter of my first novel, Lovers and Tyrants. So that's the extent of Charles Olson's influence on me. It was very, very vast. It was a kind of paternal censorship, which actually turned out to be a liberation.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me that that kind of discipline is really a mixed blessing. On the one hand, he said, don't publish for 10 years, keep a journal. And you did, and I'm sure it was good discipline to write that journal, and maybe it was a good idea to not publish too soon. On the other hand, that's a very authoritarian thing to tell someone, and surely he can't be that much of a visionary that he knew that it would take 10 years until you had something worth printing.
No, I think that this is really a very paradoxical story, and I think I don't have a copy of my book in front of me, but I think the very last sentence of my essay on Olson expresses that. I talk about the bittersweet irony of being liberated by an authoritarian and imposing male, because these, you know, everything is a gamble, my dear. To rebel against authority is a gamble, and to accept authority can be a gamble, too. Either one can be liberating, and one can be as shackling as the other. Rebellion can be very shackling, too. In this case, paradoxically, I was lucky, and obeying authority, obeying the paternal authority, enriched me. But I'm not saying that it's for everyone, and I think that every time we either obey or disobey, we take a gamble. See what I mean?
Well, I wonder if you think it's been hard for women students to rebel against male teachers.
Well, I think many male teachers are much worse than Olson, because I've heard horror stories about the kind of macho writers who teach short fiction workshops at the new school. They really like to make the women suffer. A lot of them are very sadistic. And I've seen a lot of women come out in tears from those workshops. And yet they are inciting them to write, inciting them to publish. And maybe it would be more charitable to say to the people who are trying to be fiction writers, you're not ready yet. Spend a few years just digging into your own emotions. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that ultimately he may have been on the surface more authoritarian, but in the long run more liberating than all those macho stars at the new school running workshops where women are crying all over the place. So he was for me a fructifying and nourishing presence, but then I did not see him again. You know, we were very geographically separated. I think ultimately you have to have somebody give you a kind of guidance, which often has to be in terms of censorship, and that this could be as creative as false encouragement.
Do you mean censorship, or do you mean just some sense of your limits?
I think sense of the limits is probably right. I use censorship in more of a Freudian way of suppressing certain, for a time being, certain like more orphic drives to write bad driveling poetry, whatever, and just stick to your guns with keeping the daily journal and just honing your prose that way, and doing it in great privacy and perhaps secrecy. And there are many ways out, but I think it's as good a way as any other, you know.
My guest is novelist and journalist Francine Duplessis-Gray. A new collection of her essays has just been published. It's titled Adam and Eve and the City. One of the essays in your book is on the trial of Klaus Barbie, the Gestapo chief who was extradited from Latin America to France to stand trial for crimes against humanity. And going back to France brought you back to memories of your childhood and memories with how you fled with your mother from France during World War II. All you say about that was that the experience was terrifying. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? When did you leave France, and what was it like as you were leaving? Was it difficult to get out?
Yeah, it was pretty hard, because we left in 1941, in January, And we were under the German occupation for several months in the northern zone in 1940. Then we went to the free zone. And we are very aware that my father had been one of the first heroes of the resistance and that the Germans would not let us get out easily. I guess one of the scariest moments was getting out through the Pyrenees into Spain, because we were in the company of the man who would become my stepfather, who was Jewish, and my mother's companion. And that was really very tricky. They were not letting any Jews out. As you know, they were putting them all in concentration camps. I remember the three of us being smuggled by a cab whom we had bribed, getting to Madrid, taking the last train that was leaving that month to Portugal, to Lisbon, where we were supposed to take the boat. And I remember the train being so packed that my stepfather-to-be to push my mother and me into the train. My mother refused to get on because it was so unbelievably crowded. And he pushed us on and forced us to get on. And we stood for about 16 hours all the way to Lisbon in the John, hanging on the straps, with a long four of five people in a tiny, tiny space. And I suppose there was so little petrol, so little gasoline that was the last train of the month. And this kind of strikes me as a kind of providential notion. Then the other problem is, of course, is that I was not told that my father had died. And I think, you know, you might ask me a question about that, because that is a very, very difficult problem which comes in when we turn to the suppression of memory and the suppression of mourning and the suppression of grief.
Well, I guess what interests me about your father, among other things, is that you had never really spent any time to investigate his life until a few years ago you went to France for the Klaus Barbie trial. And I wonder why you had waited that long to try to find out more about the circumstances of his death and the last few years of his life.
Well, I think that it could be useful here to use a phrase of Freud's, which he calls the work of mourning, M-O-U-R, the work of mourning. It's in a seminal essay called Mourning and Melancholia, which he wrote in the first year of World War I in 1915, and in which he talks about how many people do not dare to undertake the work of mourning, which involves the acceptance of the death of a loved one. And it's real work. You have to go over every detail of the circumstance, shared sites of memory, shared ideas, shared conversations, and test it against reality. No, that person is dead. I simply never dared to do that until my 40s. And so I really only began to do the work of mourning about 25 years after the fact. And I think that, in a way, knowing the exact details of the death, as I did when I had to research the Barbie story, was really kind of completing the work of mourning. I think many of us who lost parents in World War II, especially those of us who lost them to the anonymous mass graves of concentration camps, were deprived of proper grief and mourning because there were no tombs, no graves, no sites. And that's one of the problems that I had with my memory of death. And I think that's why I identify so much also with survivors of the Holocaust.
I'm sure you were also in mourning for your country, which you were forced to leave when you were, what, about 10 years old?
Right.
Now, a lot of people who leave their country leave as political exiles, and they can never go back unless there's a revolution in their country, because they're going to face exile or execution. After the war, you could have gone back. Of course, you were too young to go back independently. But obviously, throughout your adult life, you've decided to return to France only for visits, but never to go back to live.
I went back to live between 54 and 56. Ah. And it was a disaster. I just got mixed up with a bunch of macho male pigs, if you excuse me, Frenchmen, who were just the most appalling sexists I've ever known. I mean, I think they're worse than anybody in the Mediterranean area. And I was profoundly miserable. And in 56, I came back to New York and married an American and have been fairly steady ever since. But
let's back up here. What was so terrible about these men?
Well, the narcissism and the sort of belated childhood of the average French male in the 50s, at least, as I experienced, and was something quite extraordinary. You know, they're used to living with their moms until the day they marry. And they go on living with their moms until their 30s or their 40s, or this is the way it was still in the 1950s. And they're always at home when they go through university and graduate school and law school, whatever. And they're just very, very spoiled. They want every woman to be both a mistress and a mother and stay very much in the background while keeping their own harem at play. And these are the kind of men I kept running into when I was 24, 5, 6, working in Paris in fashion journalism. And it's not a society that I've ever wanted to live in again. Also, I think very, very petty and stingy and ungenerous compared to American society. But I feel very, very jingoistic about American values of acceptance and generosity and hospitality. I doubt if any other society has it as much as we have, you know, and I've just gotten spoiled.
So you think American men are less sexist than French men, huh?
Oh, I think American men have made great strides in the past decades, very, very great strides. I think it's been hard on the older ones, and I think it's going to be very interesting to know how the work of home is going to be divided in the next 10, 20, 30 years when half the doctors, half the lawyers in the world are women. I think it's going to be a very interesting new kind of society.
My guest is Francine Duplessis-Gray. She's a novelist and a journalist, and a collection of her essays has just been published in a new book called Adam and Eve and the City. And I want to talk with you more about some of the issues raised by these essays, but first we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Francine Duplessis-Gray, who is joining us from the NPR studios in New York. You devote several of your essays to profiling American Catholics who were active as active in the civil disobedience movement against the war in Vietnam. And you say that as a French Catholic in America, you were really struck by the conservatism of Catholicism in America. And I was wondering if you could give a couple of examples of how American Catholics seemed more conservative than French Catholics.
Well, I was brought up by a French Catholic intelligentsia, speaking of my father and my uncles and aunts, whose faith was always deeply tinged with doubt. As one of my uncles used to say, anybody who's dead sure is dead. And they were extremely philosophical about, and almost Zen-like in their approach to faith, that any true faith is always tortured by doubt and tinged with skepticism. And they sent their kids to whatever the best schools were, not to parochial schools, not to church schools. And then I suddenly find myself, when I first written my little book on Catholic radicals, as an example for you of the parochialism of American Catholics, at a church breakfast in which a woman said to me, "How can you consider yourself a Catholic if you don't send your children to parochial school?" So that these are the two great extremes, but I think it is this tendency of the traditional American Irish Catholic community, as I knew it in the 40s and 50s, which contrasted strongly with that more sophisticated, more, if you say, cynical, maybe also more jaded, but also deeper kind of faith, which I was acquainted with in France. And I think the answer, obviously, is that the Catholics were a minority in the United States and had to keep very tightly knit, as against a majority in Europe, in the European Catholic nations.
In some ways, it seems that the rationale for the leftist civil disobedience of the 60s has been picked up in the 80s by people who are politically to the right. And I'm thinking that a lot of people who oppose abortion have tried civil disobedience actions to oppose abortion. And even in the Iran-Contra hearings, we've heard about people who thought that they were following a higher motive in breaking the laws. And I wonder if you think that the philosophy of civil disobedience has been picked up by the right during this
time. Oh, I think it's the most striking phenomenon of our time. That, in a way, Arlie North is the right-wing Berrigan of the 80s. That it is, I think they learned a huge amount from the left of center civil disobedience of the 1960s and 70s. They learned enormously from the tactics, from the kind of lobbying, the kind of pressuring, the organizational methods of the left, and they are applying it to their own values and purposes. Now, mind you, I think one of the, this leads me to an issue which I find is terribly important, which is that I think the one of the most important things that the so-called left or so-called liberals can do is to reclaim family values and all the larger values that they represent of being good parents, of taking good care of your children and family compassion and close ties and so on, reclaiming it from the right and reclaiming it from the moral majority, because we are in a phase right now where the moral majority is really claiming to be the only wing of the country, to be strong on family values. And now, this does not have so much to do with civil disobedience, but it will lead to that in the sense that, as we already know, moral majority people and born-agains have bombed and attacked abortion centers, right? So there is a right-wing force doing civil disobedience for their own purposes and ends against what is presently the law of the land. And I think it's just one horrendous instance, and I think it is where we liberals have to come back and reclaim certain mutual territory which we might share with the right wing.
You've written very eloquently over the years about the women's movement and women's issues. And I want to ask you to explain a term which I think you coined. I think you coined the sexual industrial complex.
Yeah.
I like that. Why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, I guess I'm more aware of it than other people because I live in a corner of Connecticut in Litchfield County, which has currently become very fashionable. And within a few miles of me are living, well, I have to stress that I don't see these people, but I see them, you know, shopping, I see them in their limousines. From a few miles radius, there is Henry Kissinger, Bill Blask, Oscar de la Renta, Dan Furstenberg, and just a dozen of people of that kind who are both in politics and in couture and fashion. And there has been this strange kind of alliance there. I think Nancy Reagan has made a lot of it. I mean, the whole alliance between the right-wing White House politics and the fashion world in the last few years is very evident. And I think, however, the sexual industrial complex is a much larger category than that, those particular kind of alliances. I see it at work in, for instance, in the pressuring of pressuring women writers to write more erotically or more pornographically, because there's a certain kind of female porn chic which has been fashionable, was certainly in the 70s. That's one aspect of it. The whole couture industry, which, like this year, is telling us we have to cut our hems or buy 20 new skirts to have to look like tramps in the street. And the whole short hem vogue is another example of the industrial complex at work, which is a complex led by a handful of male tycoons still, and exploits women for financial purposes. And I think that's part of what I mean by this very vast term of the sexual industrial complex.
You were, in a way, brought up in the fashion world. Your stepfather was an editor at Condé Nast Publications, and I believe your mother was involved in the fashion world, too.
She was a hat designer, to be exact, yeah.
And early on in your career, you worked for the French fashion magazine Elle. Was it hard to get out of that and to assert your independence?
Yes, it was very hard because I love my parents, and I think one of the great, great problems that women have towards their mothers when they're growing up is that they want to break with mom and break from the pattern that mom has set. At the same time, they want to retain mom's love. And I think that's another very dominant theme in the parts of my book in which I discuss women's issues, is this very tight mother-daughter bond. I go into that issue at great depth in the recent issue of the Paris Review, in which I have this interview in the Authors at Work, in which I discuss the fact that for years We thought that women were primarily attracted to their father. That was a sort of a Freudian idea. And I think we realized that really they do a lot to please their mothers. And I think in my own case, I was trying to please my mother by following her footsteps, by trying to be good in her world, which is the fashion world. And I ended up close to a nervous breakdown because I'm not my mother. None of us are our mothers. And we all have to find some ways of retaining our love for our mothers and being able to strike out in totally different paths.
It's ironic in a way that the fashion world was one of the first places for women professionals as writers and as designers.
Yes.
But on the other hand, you could make the case that it's also the fashion world that has upheld the traditional values of women's place in society through certain clothes that really are describe powerlessness and describe women as beautiful adornments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, I think almost everything that if you see it with any depth is paradoxical. and I think Chanel herself is an extraordinary paradox, that my essay on Chanel in this new book sets out the paradox that here's this woman who really liberated women's bodies like nobody else before, who threw away the corsets and all the constraints, and I was the first one to show women what they were as individuals and not as part of men's chattel and not as a possession of the male. And yet she herself lived a very conventional love life in a state of complete subservience to a lot of moronic, wealthy men. And her fashion, she created an empire, which is part of the sexual industrial complex, which then after her death began to be run by men. So there is always a pro and the con. It's sort of like Olsen's authoritarian action liberating me. Chanel, in many ways a revolutionary, in many ways a conservative woman, still liberating women in many ways. So I think the paradox lies right there.
Well, in a way, you've just brought us back to where we started, to the beginning of your story as a writer, with the paradox of Olsen's advice. And with that, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Terry. Always a pleasure.
My guest has been Francine Duplessis Gray. Her new book, Adam and Eve and the City, is a collection of essays that she's written over the past 18 years. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.